Hello and welcome to the Righteous Rumble podcast. My name's Jimmy and I voted to leave the EU in 2016.
And my name's Jazza, and this is no word of a lie. When I looked down at my phone this afternoon and found that Parliament were going to get a binding vote on the final Brexit deal, I genuinely squealed at the top of my lungs in the middle of a lecture. It was really fun.
How did the rest of the lecture respond?
Everybody turned around and said, "What is it?" And I said, "Parliament are getting a binding vote on the final Brexit deal." And they all looked at me very confused. They all seem very politely happy for me, though. There's a lot of Canadians in my class.
Oh, right. Is it a lot of foreign students?
So. Yeah, it's mainly foreigners. They're all incredibly happy.
Okay, so they sort of don't really give a shit. They're like, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Deets. It's not actually a very... It's not really a very substantial vote, though, is it?
Yeah, it's not... Like, apparently, if we drop out... without a if there is no deal, then there is no vote, and so there isn't really a chance of reversing anything, just kind of delaying it.
Well, I also thought that if the deal is put before Parliament and Parliament say no, then we have no deal, which will probably be worse, particularly from the Remain point of view.
Yeah, like objectively worse. But also maybe shoot ourselves in the foot will be fun. We did it last year.
I think we're marching towards our glorious post-Brexit future, but that's just what I figured.
I just want you to be honest with me one day, Jimmy, and admit that this is a shit show.
I think that was the exact word that I used, actually, to describe the ongoing Brexit negotiations and the general course of things.
Good.
So, I mean, in my opinion, not that it counts for much, the Conservative government should probably pause Article 50 somehow, which I think diplomatically probably is possible, and then sort themselves and or Parliament and or the Labour Party out in some fashion. Probably, like, realistically form a grand coalition, have a proper discussion on how they're going to do this, and then, you know, press ahead, basically.
Press ahead, the honourable thing to do.
Yeah, I mean...
Over the top, boys!
It's all... It's not that bad, jeez. The thing is, however bad Brexit is, it won't be as bad as Ramonas have predicted it will be.
But are World War One analogies appropriate? Probably.
Are they, though? I mean, trench warfare was, like, very specific to that time period.
I don't know, that us against the Germans.
But isn't it...
Et cetera.
It's a Frenchman who's leading the EU talks, or the talks from the EU side.
Oh, yeah. Well, his name is Michel. I've never actually... Isn't he Belgian?
How is he Belgian?
I don't know.
I mean, they're basically, French, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. He's just... Oh, my God, no. You cannot say that. That's a very sensitive issue, Jimmy.
They're in the same filing cabinet, you know.
No!
They're in the same folder in the filing cabinet.
What are we going to talk about this week, Jimmy? Hello, by the way, dear listener. We talk about politics, social issues and current events. Sometimes every week, but sometimes we inadvertently take fortnightly breaks because Jimmy can't be arsed.
That's really unfair. Usually it's your fault. So we're going to be throwing shade around here. I think we need to hit the right targets, you know.
Can I just also say, I really like that I'm getting you saying drag queen slang, like throwing shade.
Is that drag queen slang?
It's drag queen slang, yes.
It's going to be about 5 years' time, they're going to be like, yeah, that straight guy was really weird. He used a lot of gay slang, just a lot.
You need to stop hanging out with me. What are we going to talk about this week, Jimmy, for goodness sake?
So, on the theme of Tory incompetence, we're going to be discussing the forced resignation of Priti Patel, who up until recently was the Foreign Aid Secretary or Minister. I can't remember which title it is, but she was found to have had undisclosed meetings with Israeli officials while she was on holiday. And when this emerged, the scandal unfolded over 24 hours. She was asked by Theresa May to come back from Africa. And the press gleefully kind of charted her course home via flight radar.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
Hashtag has Priti landed yet?
Yeah, very. It sort of calls to mind the scandal ages ago where I can't remember, this woman was getting on a plane to Africa and she tweeted some AIDS joke, and by the time she landed, her employer had decided to sack her, and there was a whole Twitter storm around it.
Very sad.
Yeah, and in kind of similar, but...
What, in that it involves somebody being on holiday?
No, well, yeah, I guess so. But I was about to segue to the related topic of Boris Johnson, who's... do you want to run through the details of this?
So, Boris Johnson, in case you have forgotten, dear listener, is still our foreign secretary. He has accidentally put his foot in it slightly with some words that he chose to speak about a British about a British citizen called Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, who is currently in jail in Iran. Accused of partaking in espionage and of training journalists, I believe, is what she's actually been charged with. Boris Johnson said that she had indeed been training journalists, where actually the story anyway is that she was there visiting family and that was just there on holiday and has been unfairly jailed by the Iranian authorities. Boris Johnson confirming the Iranian line on this has kind of made things a little bit worse for Nazanin, and now her husband has been breaking all of our hearts on every single news broadcast across the country over the last couple of days.
The way you sort of reported that, it made it sound as though you're not 100% convinced that that Boris Johnson was incorrect.
I actually don't think that matters. I don't think that matters, and I don't think it's helpful to speculate. Let's be clear. Even though, as a relatively small podcast, it doesn't really matter what we say or what we think. let's be real.
Preparing the legal defense as we begin.
Yeah, but the point is, I don't think that it matters what she was actually doing. The defense secretary should not, the foreign secretary should not be saying stuff that will put British citizens' lives in danger, and that's exactly what Boris Johnson has done.
Yes, indeed. So, I mean, this kind of, the two topics together show the...
Well, we've basically just covered them.
Well, kind of, yeah, the heavily weakened state of the Tory party. And kind of just linking finally to that, and then we will introduce the other two topics. 40 MPs are reported by the Sunday Times to have signed a letter expressing no confidence, or are prepared to sign a letter expressing no confidence in Theresa May. If 8 more MPs agree to do so, it would trigger a leadership election in the Tory party, and
then we'd get Jacob Rees-Mogg as Prime Minister.
Yeah, quite possibly. We probably shouldn't say anything more on that because we do need to introduce the other two topics. Jazza, what was the second topic? Because I've already forgotten, naturally.
The second topic was the Paradise Papers.
Oh yeah, you wanted to do this, so you should introduce it.
Do you remember a couple of years ago, I believe it was actually 2014, when there were a load of papers from Panama? Was it 2014 or was it last year?
I think it was last year, actually.
It was last year. So the Panama Papers showed that a load of dodgy people had been evading tax in Panama. Well, now there's another set of papers called the Paradise Papers, because they're more generically offshore-y rather than a specific country. And we found out... Offshore-y, yeah, it's a word now. And we found out that the Queen's private estate has invested offshore. Lewis Hamilton has $3.3 million stored offshore. It's all a little bit of a shit show. And also Bono... This is
the U2 singer.
Yeah, Bono, the U2 singer, who encourages people to give their money to charities and for governments to give more money to developing countries in the form of aid. He has like an offshore fund, but via owning a shopping center in Lithuania, which is odd and strange. But what would be nice, Bono, is if he would actually choose to maybe pay a little bit of the tax that he owes in his home country of Ireland, and rather than getting us to foot the bill for him. So we're going to be talking about why nobody actually seems to care about this. Anyway.
Jazz is deeply upset. Deeply, deeply upset.
Deeply.
So for our third topic, we've somewhat missed the boat on this, but that doesn't usually stop us. The Sunday just passed, and the weekend just passed was Remembrance Day in the UK, which for our foreign listeners is when we commemorate our war dead, specifically relating to World War One, but more broadly
and
related.
World War II.
Well, every conflict really subsequent to that, but
what's it called? Veterans Day in the United States.
Yes, yeah. Although Americans, I think Americans think a lot more and care a lot more, at least politically speaking, about their veterans than we do. But yeah, there's been kind of over the past couple of years an annual, Farrar is probably putting it a bit too strongly, but like a squabble over like the role of the poppy, which is the symbol that is used to mark Remembrance Day, and everyone, people are generally expected, or this is the argument, to wear a little plastic poppy to kind of show their support and remembrance for the war dead. But as a symbol, it's become increasingly controversial, and there's been stories about kind of poppy burnings, which are probably less common than you might read in some of the tabloid press. But I think it's kind of an interesting story in the context of how people feel about their national identity, and obviously the Brexit thing being kind of pertinent to this in general. So I'm forcing Jazza to talk to me about this, basically.
Yay, nationalism. So in summary, we have a story about how Theresa May is probably not going to have her job very soon, a story that Jimmy isn't interested in, and a story that I'm not interested in. So basically, this is going to be a classic Right Dishonourable episode.
Yeah, very much so.
Excellent.
Should we play some music and beg the people for money?
I love it when we do that. Let's.
So at The Right Dishonourable, we are currently in the process of setting up a proper Patreon. We already have a page that you can access at patreon.com/rightdishonourable. There you'll find the various pledge options. They include goodies like mugs, badges, and access to extra content via the Patreon page. If you like the podcast, if you enjoy what we do, and you feel that you can spare the money, it will go largely to sorting out some of our costs. We have things like hosting, both for the podcast and for the website, and various other bits and pieces that we use. The more money we have, the more ambitious we will get in terms of trying new things. So if that's something that you would like to see, then throw some money our way. But if you feel the money could be better used elsewhere, then please don't feel obliged. The podcast will always be free to listen to. That will not change, although the composition of the Patreon setup probably will change as time goes on. But head over to the page itself for details. In the meantime, I need to give a shout out to our current patrons. They include Dominic Flood, Matt, Gemma Cumming, Agatha Hoder, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, and Ollie McGregor. Thank you to all of you for contributing money to make this thing happen. So in our long, rambling 10-minute intro, we pretty much introduce
this. Stop putting us down, for goodness sake.
It's a branding thing, mate. It's, you know, it's part of the overall theme, vibe, whatever. Anyway.
it's for the people subscribe for. Don't put us down.
Yeah, okay. But in that introduction, we pretty much highlighted and explained what's been going on in the past couple of weeks. It has been a little while since we recorded an episode, but Priti Patel was forced to step down. I mean, she was effectively all but sacked because of her meetings with Israeli officials. And then Boris Johnson perhaps should have been sacked for landing, what's her name again?
Nazanin Zaghari-Ratcliffe.
There you go. Zaghari-Ratcliffe in the, well, in even more trouble than she already is in, through his comments. And we also have the ongoing turmoil of Brexit and the letter that I mentioned, or the potential letter reported in the Sunday Times of 40 MPs mm-hmm. being willing to effectively submit a vote of no confidence and bring down Theresa May and her government, really, by implication. Chaz, you said as we were finishing the intro that you thought this... You suggested that Theresa May might be on the way out, but is that something that you actually think is true?
So this was actually... I was listening to another podcast over the week. Yeah, I know. I've been cheating on us.
A rival podcast.
And I actually can't remember which one it was, but somebody talks about how wonderfully... inappropriate is to talk about Theresa May losing her job, because people talked about, I think it was actually Laura Kunzberg who talked about this, the BBC political editor, who said that people were talking about John Major after he got a very, very slim majority and eventually lost it in 1992, talking about him losing his job all the way up until the end of his parliament in 1997. Mm. And the same thing happening with Gordon Brown when he took power in 2007, when he chose not to then call an election at that time. And then he kind of clung on to power until 2010, despite the fact that he was incredibly unpopular, both amongst the electorate and within his own party. Mm. I think we're going to have Theresa May hanging around for a reasonably long time. I don't understand why you would want to have somebody else in, unless you are someone who wants to completely derail Brexit, in which case, good on ya. But if you are a run-of-the-mill Tory politician, I don't understand why you would want Theresa May to leave, because it's just going to be another... Like, who wants to pick up the shit show and carry it, you know?
Well, I guess you don't need that many Tory MPs to want her to leave for, you know, a coup to be mounted. I mean, we mentioned the 48, the 40 MPs who, according to the Sunday Times, are already interested in submitting a vote of no confidence against her. But partly because of the slenderness of the Tories' majority at the moment, or, you know, minority, but majority with the DUP in Ireland, people, backbenchers who are opposed to whoever it is in charge, be it Theresa May or somebody else, do have more leverage than they otherwise might?
Mm-hmm. No, that's 100% true. This is a government of... Well, this is a parliament of backbenchers, both for the Labour Party and for the Conservative Party, because the margins are so small, their voices and them voting along with the rest of their party or otherwise is ever more consequential.
I mean, we didn't mention this in the we did mention this, I think, in the unreleased episode that we recorded, but Michael Fallon, who was the former defense secretary and who was brought down through kind of various allegations of sexual misconduct, was brought down I think by Andrea Leadsom, who said that she was going to release some details to the press, at least that's what I read, and effectively forced him being removed, which...
Yeah, that is basically hearsay, but is what everyone assumes to be true right now, right?
Yeah, and if you do assume that is true, then that means Andrea Leadsom is also one of Theresa May's ministers. I don't know if she qualifies as a full cabinet minister. Can't remember her position, but...
She is the head of the House of Commons.
Okay, yeah, so I don't think that does. But there you go, you still have a prominent Tory who effectively is bringing down members of the cabinet. And, I mean, it doesn't excuse what it is he's alleged to have done. But it still means that you have kind of open warfare going on.
And this just showed, like, a wider problem that Theresa May has. It isn't just government ministers like Priti Patel going behind her back and having ministerial meetings outside of her capacity as a minister, because she hasn't been briefed by the Foreign Office, because she didn't seek permission to do so from her Prime Minister. Like, that is not something that should be... she was right to be sacked. And then you have Boris Johnson, who has proved himself to be incredibly incompetent in the role that he has as Foreign Secretary, insulting a number of countries accidentally across the globe that he has ended up visiting, and putting the life of a British subject in jeopardy.
Mm-hmm.
If any other, so, and she also has a chancellor who is well known to clash heads with her and to disagree with her. All of these people would have, if she had won that majority that she wanted in the general election that she called this year, bless her, she did make a mistake, didn't she? Then these people would have all been shuffled out, and there would probably be a new generation of Conservative MPs hosting,
having those. Probably the case.
Right? Yeah.
Maybe with the exception of Boris Johnson, because there is an argument that she needed to include some kind of the main Leave campaigners just to retain unity within her party, particularly given that the Tory membership at large, that is just standard Tory members, do lean Leave. I think it's like 2/3 to 1/3 or something.
Who are one of the smallest parties, at least the smallest of the larger parties in the UK. They only have like a couple of 100,000 members.
Yeah, well, how many did Labour has, what, 600,000 at this point? Or something,
yeah, something
in that
like,
region?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's, I mean, I to go back to kind of your original points about Theresa May potentially losing her job, I went to just sort of looked back at all of the post-World War II prime ministers just to see how their 10 years had ended effectively, and when you break it down,
do you mean to say, Jimmy, you did research?
I did do some research. I know it's not our usual style, but I, you know, break with tradition and all that.
No, I'm proud of you.
If you break it down by whether they were effectively forced to resign or had to quit, either for like health reasons or they just lost support to their colleagues or what have you, versus the number of leaders that were forced to stand down as a result of losing an election, it comes down to about half and half. I mean, there's two, I think it's Churchill and Wilson, who actually effectively stopped being prime minister twice, but then actually had like two separate stints at it, if you will. And Churchill the second time, actually both of them the second time round, ended up resigning for health related reasons, I think.
Did you see anything that mirrored Theresa May's circumstances here, other than John Major and Gordon Brown that I talked about earlier?
I don't think so. I mean, there was that case where there were two general elections in short succession. I think was that the Wilson Heath? Sorry, the Wilson Heath sort of era. I can't remember.
Yeah, I believe so. Something in the '70s. Come on, if you do your research, Jimmy.
Well, I did broad research. And as I said, it's about half and half. Half of, like, since World War II, half of prime ministers have lost their jobs because they were booted out of office through, like, resigning or their colleagues gagged up on them. And then the other half lost at the ballot box. And, you know.
But then technically, hasn't Theresa May actually suffered both of those humiliations but has still got her job? So she's lost a general election by not getting a majority.
Oh, but she won the general election under the terms by which general elections are won.
But the common parlance is that nobody won that election. And I think that is a fair... Like, she's unable to govern efficiently with the general election result that she got.
Yes, that is definitely true. But I think And, you know, obviously, if she was to be... booted out as leader of the Tory party through action from the Tory MPs, then you would trace it back to her election defeat. But she still managed to retain power after a general election, and she still effectively won that general election. She still retains a majority of support via the Conservatives and the DUP in the House of Commons, which is how we elect our prime ministers.
We should probably talk about the... like the sexual abuse scandals that has been gripping Westminster. We've only seen one person have to resign because of that, and that was the Defence Secretary, Michael Fallon, who you mentioned earlier. There is a danger, because there was a list released of basically sex pest.
Some of them were just people having affairs. Yeah, so it was mixed.
Yeah, there were some people released on this list of Conservative MPs who... like ranged from, as you said, Jimmy, just having an affair with somebody consensually, all the way through to genuinely quite severe sexual assault and really inappropriate behaviour. And not all of these people have been made publicly public knowledge yet. And so it feels almost inevitable that there are going to be more resignations in the coming weeks. Do you agree with me there? And do you think that that is going to affect Theresa May in any way? Or is she just going to continue with the one-in, one-out system that she seems to be implementing at the moment when it comes to losing a minister and then having to put somebody new in?
Well, there's the whole Damien Green thing. So Damien Green's her deputy prime minister, and apparently the police, when they were conducting a raid on his parliamentary office, found, quote, extreme pornography on his computer. What that actually means in practice, I don't know.
It means lots of people on BMX bikes having sex.
Yeah, extreme porn could be like a lot of things, and it doesn't I mean, if it was illegal, presumably he would have been prosecuted for it at the time. So it might just be like a weird fetish, you know, which will potentially be...
If it isn't illegal, it sounds like a strange thing to have a public statement about.
Yeah, so I don't know what the original providence of, like... I don't know how we found out that he had extreme porn on his computer, allegedly. I don't know where that originally came from. But yeah, I mean, if it's not illegal, then it is, you know, it's purely just his own private fetish, and, you know... I don't really think we should be going around like harassing ministers for whatever it is they are particularly into. I mean, he is also accused of like trying to get kind of young Tory party sort of members and that sort of thing into bed, isn't he? And or accused of having affairs more broadly. So there is that, which is another thing. But it appears to be the extreme pornography allegation that has caused more interest as it goes.
I mean, I think that causes more interest because it like certain types of pornography are very clearly prohibited by law, and so it's easier to convict somebody on that charge rather than a sexual assault claim, which is often a lot more difficult to get a clear verdict on because it's so often one person's word against another.
Yes. Yeah, I guess. I mean, one thing that has kind of struck me is that although I imagine that a lot of these allegations do have substance to them, there is a slight element of any kind of allegation that gets brought up immediately is given quite a high level of credibility, or it's taken sort of on trust that it's probably true, which doesn't seem to me to be entirely helpful.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of hard to talk about any claim in particular just because of the obvious legalities around the situation. But I mean, to sort of take the Daily Mail line as a question here, do you think there is a slight witch hunt going on here?
Yeah, and there are witches.
Right.
There have been I think in the last few hours actually somebody has also claimed that the former president of the United States, George Bush Senior, groped a 16-year-old in 2013 when he was taking a photo with her.
There are multiple similar allegations, but yeah, the 16-year-old one has just appeared in the
news. So there is always kind of this discussion whenever these kinds of things are get traction, in that how many of these are like copycat cases in terms of people saying stuff for the sake of it, and how much of it is people who have genuinely been sexually assaulted. I almost always land on the side of believing those, like there's no smoke without fire, and these women, it takes an awful lot of balls for these men and women to come forward and to actually put their names to being the victims of sexual assault, and I think that it's actually a really, really good thing.
I think it's a dangerous line of reasoning to say there's no smoke without fire. However, if there are, say, I mean, in the
but
case
when, no, but when no, like
when there are many, many when there are many, many people who come forward with similar allegations against the same person, then you can make the deduction that yes, what is being said is probably true. Yeah, if you let me finish, man, you know, I will agree with you in the end.
No, never. But yeah, I think that there is a witch hunt, and I think there is quite rightly a witch hunt, because the witches be real.
I mean, do you think that this is actually, it's the case that a lot of politicians are actually guilty of sexual misconduct in some form, or do you think that it's easy to have that perception just because we have a lot of those kind of stories in the news at the moment?
I mean, well, also, there's only 650 of them, and it seems like it's a scarily large proportion of them who do partake in this kind of behaviour. I think whenever you have a huge power disparity between workers, so when you have, for example, an MP and their aides, there is a huge difference in the amount of power that those people have. When you have a workforce like people who end up working in Parliament, whether those be aides or researchers or the like, they do not have any kind of like organization or a HR department, because their HR department is often the MP who could possibly be inappropriate towards them, then I think that environment breeds this kind of behavior and doesn't necessarily breed this kind of behavior. Sorry, I'll correct myself there. It makes this kind of behavior possible and easy to get away with for long periods of time. And that is exactly what we've ended up seeing here.
I mean, you probably could use the word breeds in the sense that there are certain conditions where, you know, sexual misconduct is more likely to happen than in other conditions,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't. It's very possible, I think, that politicians are maybe more prone to it than, or politics in general is more prone to it than other industries, just because of the nature of the job. I mean, most jobs do not have several workplace site.
No, sure, but we've also seen across the Atlantic, they're having huge conversations about their entertainment industry in Hollywood after the Harvey Weinstein, the Kevin Spacey allegations that are now out there and being talked about very frankly in the US media, where there exists again a very similar dynamic between unprotected workers, like actresses very often, or young actors, and very powerful men who are seen to the decision makers who people can end up reporting.
Yeah, or people who are the gatekeepers to that particular industry.
Exactly, yeah. That's the right word. Yeah, you're right.
It would be interesting if, like, it was the Harvey Weinstein scandal blowing across the Atlantic that eventually felled the Tory government, or Theresa May's Tory government, would be kind of.
Yeah, I don't think the two are unlinked. I don't think the two are unlinked, and I think the ability to be able to have this conversation on this side of the Atlantic in a similar way to how they're doing it over in the US, that does have something to do with the fact that they're both happening at the same time, and that the Harvey Weinstein allegations ended up coming out first. I think that has helped.
Yes. Do you want to talk about tax evasion?
Oh, I'd love to.
So do you want to roughly introduce these Paradise Papers and why you're so upset that people don't seem to care about people dodging tax?
So a number of stories have been appearing about people partaking in specifically tax evasion. No, tax avoidance rather than tax evasion. Tax evasion is not paying tax that you legally need to pay.
So tax evasion is illegal then?
Tax evasion is illegal and you can go to prison for that. Tax avoidance is paying as little tax as you legally can. And so that will often include people having offshore accounts, having dubious business interests and business investments, like Bono owning a Lithuanian shopping center.
You're really upset about that.
I mean, no, I'm not upset about it. It's just odd. It's so... What? Lithuania and a shopping center and Bono. Who knew? It sounds like the start of a really bad joke. we have had these kinds of allegations before, and they've been not allegations, these kinds of stories and revelations before. With, as we've talked in the introduction, the Panama Papers, it's gotten to the point with British celebrities where I don't think it is possible for them to partake in offshore accounting anymore because of the heat that people like Gary Barlow and Jimmy Carr have had in the past with their own financial situations. But aside from that, and the idea that like people who now partake in tax avoidance, the legal version of this, are now kind of we can all say that they are immoral, and the people that partake in it are making it, they can't claim ignorance anymore, right?
On the point of tax avoidance, there is this argument that is made, well, I'm actually going to make, that we all engage in tax avoidance to a certain degree, even if we own, if invested money in an ISA, which is an investment vehicle deliberately designed to minimise your tax, from capital gains or something. Because usually you have to pay tax if you invest money and make a return on it, but ISA, the tax rate is very low or non-existent. I don't remember the details.
ISA, I believe the tax is non-existent.
Right.
Although, to be honest, now that I've said it, I'm doubting myself. This is what happens when we talk about economics, Jim.
But the point is that there are some financial investment vehicles that we all have access to which can lower your tax liability.
Right? Yeah, but I feel like there is obviously a point where, for example, Lewis Hamilton ends up not paying £3 million in tax on a private jet that he buys. That seems unfair. And when like TV stars of Mrs. Brown Boys, which is an appalling TV show by the fucking way, evaded like £2 million of tax, that is also seen as unfair. And I find it very frustrating that there is little that we can do and that we seem willing to do, as like not just in terms of like our government, but also as people, to actually care about the amount that people are avoiding in tax. And I think that part of that is because, and feel free to shoot me down on this, a load of us wish that we were in that situation where we were able to pay an accountant to make sure that we paid as little tax as possible.
I mean, I'd definitely be willing to pay an accountant to like sort out my money for me, but that's a side issue really. I don't think it's purely an envy thing. I think there's, I mean, it genuinely is disgraceful if the super rich have like a lower proportion of their income going towards tax than if you're just a standard worker on minimum wage or something like that. I mean, the other side of that is that I can't remember what the statistic is at the moment, but there was a statistic that like the top 1% of earners in Britain pay 27% of the income tax or something like that. So the people who earn a lot of money do generally pay disproportionately into HMRC's sort of money box or whatever it is you call it. They're paying much more tax relative, like in absolute terms, but they might be paying less relative to their income.
But we have a tiered tax system.
Yeah.
But for that reason, that somebody paying 50% tax if they only earn £10,000, that affects them. That rate of tax affects them a lot more than somebody who earns £1 million and is 50% tax. Like that to me just makes sense.
Yeah, I think it makes sense. I sort of don't. I mean, this could be classed as naivety, I guess. I almost don't understand how this problem hasn't been more sorted, particularly with regards to the UK, because a lot of the tax havens are British overseas territories.
The Isle of Man,
Channel Islands as well.
Channel Islands, yeah.
I do remember that there was a Grant Shapps, when he was a government minister, went over to the Cayman Islands to ask them to put together a kind of beneficial ownership register, the idea being that you can't just own a trust through somebody else and then be hidden from public scrutiny. It has to be in the record somewhere who is the ultimate beneficiary, i.e. whose money is it ultimately that's held in these vehicles. And he asked the Cayman Islands to do this, and they just went, eh, don't really want to do it.
Well, yeah, because they don't actually have to. They have jurisdiction over
it. Well, yeah, right? Yeah. That's
and also,
thing.
If they don't do it, then there is going to be another offshore territory that decides to do it. And then there's even talk of the UK post-Brexit. If we get no deal, we're going to become a tax haven. Whoopity-fucking-do.
Yeah, I mean, if you're one of these territories that your only real industry is tourism and, you know, facilitating tax avoidance, then... I can see why you'd be reluctant to do it, but it does seem to me the UK could be doing more to actually sort this problem, particularly given our like strength in finance generally, and also, as I said, the fact that we are still, I mean, the Westminster government is still technically superior to the overseas territories governments. So in that sense, it is kind of weird to me. It sort of seems like a no-brainer, morally speaking. I'm not even really sure what the argument is in favour of allowing these offshore funds to continue existing.
Yeah, I just don't know how we legislate for it. And perhaps that helplessness is why it is, and also perhaps because we've all been tracking Priti Patel flying home from Kenya. Mm. God, good times. That was a great like 3 hours on Twitter that I had.
There is the argument that it's kind of like a global governance problem. I mean, when you have relatively free flows of capital from one jurisdiction to another, you don't have capital controls in place. It's very hard for one country to act unilaterally because, as you say, if you're if you're the Cayman Islands and you make it less attractive to put money into the Cayman Islands, it will just go to the British Virgin Islands or some other territory, and then you have to act in concert for it to actually happen. And maybe that's the main reason it hasn't happened, that it's just difficult to arrange that from a diplomatic point of view.
Well, I'm just waiting for that Star Trek future to happen when we have a global government.
How does that appear to be going in general?
Really,
terms?
Really well. Well, if people like you didn't stop stopping it, anyway.
Have we sufficiently covered this topic to your liking?
Yeah, I think so. I'm happy now.
Yeah, so to summarise...
Oh, also, yep. How do you feel about the Queen avoiding tax?
So I'm actually gonna do something kind of weird for this podcast, and I'm going to defend the Queen. I have a feeling that Jazza has brought this up chiefly so that he can hear me defend the Queen again. But
100%. This is going in the archive.
Okay, so the allegation is that millions of pounds from the Duchy of Lancaster, which is the... it's been described here on the Guardian article as the Queen's private estate, which I think is a little bit misleading. It's essentially an investment vehicle or a trust. I'm not sure what the technical term would be. Which holds a investment portfolio. I think it has businesses and land and that sort of thing. I'm thinking of the Crown Estates, actually. This is actually the income for the Queen's use personally, the Duchy of Lancaster. And it is managed officially by somebody who actually sits in cabinet, the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, which means that every government that's been in power effectively has had some hand in managing the kind of personal income of the Queen from this fund. I think it actually is used to pay for the royal family more broadly as well. But the thing is, and this is why Jazza wants me to talk about this, is that
you've seen right through me.
It's ultimately, really... it's not the Queen who is responsible for managing the fund. Somebody manages it on her behalf, and then she just gets the dividend, or like the, you know, she just gets an income from it, and then she uses it to effectively engage in diplomacy and that sort of thing, if I remember correctly, from my years ago studying of the Queen's finances. You can't really blame, like, the only person whose fault it is the person who's responsible for managing those investments on behalf of the Queen. It's not the Queen herself. She probably has very little idea how those funds are managed, I should imagine. I might be wrong. Maybe she is actually an avid fan of investment
accounting
indexes and that sort of thing, and you know, I mean, having said that, I wouldn't be surprised if she takes something of an interest in where the money goes, just from an ethical point of view, but whether she gets into enough nitty-gritty to actually know exactly where the funds are going and what sort of things that those, you know, the things that she's investing in get up to, I don't know. So yeah, I don't. I mean, it's a fun story. I get why people have run with it, but it does seem to be a little bit overblown from my cursory reading of the articles around it.
Well, God save the Queen. Jimmy, do you want to tell me why I need to care about poppies?
That wasn't a bad segue.
Thank you.
Can
you stop pointing out when we do good segues? They're meant to be good segues and seamless.
Okay, fine.
You're ruining it.
So in answer to why we should care about poppies, I don't know if you've actually kind of have a similar perception of how the view of the poppy has changed in Britain, but when I was a kid it seemed as though the poppy was less controversial than it is today. I still bought one this year, and I think that I generally have bought a poppy and worn it. Did you buy a poppy this year?
I didn't buy a poppy, but not for any particular reason. I just forgot.
You just forgot. Is that...
Yeah, never had any change on me. Like...
But in principle, you're not opposed to wearing a poppy on Remembrance Day.
No, I've never really gone out of my way to... like, if it's convenient for me to get one, I will get one, because I think that is a nice thing to do to show that solidarity and to... I think that Remembrance Sunday is actually very important for us to remember, like, the horrors of war and all of that kind of stuff. And I supporting people who have had to go to war, not necessarily for us, but people who have been sent to war by the governments that we choose. I think that is an honourable thing to do. Though apparently it's controversial, and I've not really been super aware of it. Until very recently.
Yeah, so it seems like in the last couple of years there's been reports of poppy burnings, usually from...
What does that entail?
Well, I think it's generally been from Islamist groups who are, like, unhappy with... who feel that the poppy is a representation of British imperialism, and therefore they gather poppies together and burn them in a public place. I don't think this has happened a whole lot, but when it does happen, it does tend to get reported, because... It's kind of a desecration of a national monument, in a sense, or a national symbol, I should say.
It's kind of like, do you remember that guy who swung on the cenotaph?
Yes, yeah, David Gilmour's stepson.
Oh, you remember him. Know him well. yeah, it feels like a similar thing. It feels unnecessarily disrespectful, to me anyway, to people who do something that you'd never want to bloody do, anyway. Why are people burning them? What's the point?
Well, I mean, generally...
Am I becoming a nationalist? Is this one?
Generally speaking, I don't think people are burning them, but I do know that some people are uncomfortable about wearing them now, because they feel that they've been kind of co-opted into just this symbol of militarism rather than this symbol of remembrance for people who've died.
Yeah, I understand that.
Firstly in the First World War, but then in basically every subsequent war. And so there's actually other poppies that exist, like the white poppy, which is just a general poppy of peace, and which is intended, I think, to be more international in what it symbolises and isn't so caught up with Britishness as an idea.
It is quite a strange thing for foreigners in Britain in the first couple of weeks of November, because everyone is wearing a poppy. And it is like you've landed on an island where everyone's part of this little cult. But I think that it is something quite nice that we do. And there is something really familiar and lovely about the fact that on the 11th of the 11th at 11 a.m. we all go quiet. But maybe I'm being simplistic about it. Like, I understand why some people don't want to wear the poppy, because of the symbolism that it may have. But hey, you have the power to define the symbolism of whatever you wear. Like,
somewhat. I feel symbols are more a negotiation, really. Like, I mean, to take a very extreme example, I couldn't wear a T-shirt with a swastika on and be like, no, this is
don't
like...
invoke Godwin's law, Jimmy.
It's a dumbass law. but I'm just, okay, take another. I couldn't wear like a crucifix around my neck, say on a necklace, and then say, oh, this doesn't represent Christianity, because that is what it is generally understood to mean, right?
I'm going to pass on this. I was about to say that the swastika was actually a back to front Buddhist symbol. and yes. then they said that it's a swastika now. But anyway, go on.
Well, I'm not saying symbols don't change in their meaning. I'm not saying the context doesn't matter, but that, you know, it is based, symbols are part of a sort of language by which you communicate certain things, and they do have a generally understood meaning that you can't fully just ignore when you're using mm-hmm. them, I guess, which is why you can't just go around wearing a swastika and saying, oh no, it's the Buddhist symbol meaning peace or whatever.
Yeah, Jimmy, yeah. I find it quite curious that out of the two of us, I'm the one that hasn't worn the poppy this year and you have. What why? Does it mean? Why are you wearing one? I'll tell you why. Because I am the more sentimental of the two of us, I think.
Are you though? Because I voted for Brexit and you didn't. So.
Yeah, but you voted for Brexit because of cold-hearted logic. And I voted Remain because I felt European.
Well, yeah, I mean, I sort of think it's a decent gesture. I don't really buy the idea that it means you approve of all of the military interventions and foreign wars that Britain's mm-hmm. been involved in, either before World War One or after World War One, for that matter. I think it's a fairly good thing, but I mean, this is part of the reason that I brought up this topic. I wonder, in an era where particularly young people feel less tied to their specific nation. I mean, you mentioned Europeanism, if that's a word of Europeanness. Mm-hmm. Whether the idea of commemorating the war dead specifically aligned to a single country is likely to go out of vogue, if you see what I mean.
I don't think so. I feel like young British people still feel British. It's just often they have an international outlook as well. This was the thing. I think it's very possible for people to have multiple identities. And I think actually the poppy, though it is very much tied with the tradition of the First and the Second World Wars, especially when I was growing up and I like became a teenager in the 2000s, I became really aware of the fact that it was a poppy that symbolized the people that were fighting in Iraq, for example, and the people who lost their lives there. Mm. Like, it's something that is just, these are the people who ended up doing a thing that we probably wouldn't have the balls to do. Let's just say, I think rather than saying thank you, I think it's more of a way of saying sorry, to be honest.
That's an interesting interpretation. I think it is intended as a thank you, and I think there's a mm-hmm. there's a certain amount of soft jingoism that is associated with that kind of use of the poppy.
But Jimmy, I'm wearing it, so I get to choose what the symbol means.
Okay, shall I? Fucking postmodernist. No, it just strikes me that you mentioned like sort of multiple identities or nested identities, but I think it's. And I mean, this kind of calls into the relevance of World War One in general, is that in the previous era, when countries went to war with one another, they were often going to war on the principle of kind of establishing their own national will or national sovereignty, to use a recently much abused word. In an era of like global governance, you know, free movement of people, free movement of goods and capital and services and all the rest of it, commemorating those wars and remembering those wars, aside from the fact that some of them were a very long time ago, we're obviously almost at the centenary of the end of World War One, just, it seems a bit irrelevant to me. And I say that having worn a poppy over the weekend.
Yeah, I still don't really understand why you wore a poppy.
Why I wore a poppy?
Yeah,
because it was Remembrance Sunday.
No, but why? It was Remembrance Sunday. Yeah, I want to get a reason out of you. Is it just because everybody else is doing it, or do you have like a reason?
Well, it seems like I kind of agree that with commemorating that war to a certain degree, although I do think it is becoming less relevant. Basically, and I think, but the extension of it to World War II is also fair. I understand perfectly why people feel much more ambiguous about commemorating the war dead in kind of the post World War II era.
D- Did you do the 2 minute silence?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't like grow up in a random foreign country where we didn't have war commemorations and all that sort of thing.
Did you do it this year?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Okay, so what do you think of when you do the 2 minute silence? You're so uncomfortable, and it's great.
Probably the First World War, I guess, principally. But that's the poppy symbolism comes from the First World War, doesn't it, in Flanders Fields? Mm-hmm. I mean, what do you think about when you bow your heads for 2 minutes?
So there were members of my family who have been in the forces before, and so I think of them.
Okay, well, in my recent history, sort of recent familial history, none of my kind of grandparents fought in World War II, and they weren't old enough to fight in World War I. So I think I have like an uncle or something who had a record of military service, but still like a great uncle, somewhere back in the family tree. But there's no one immediate who actually that applies to. I think I just do it out of sort of limp national conformism, which is not generally like me, but apparently is something. I don't know. I don't really feel that there's actually a massive pressure to wear poppies. I don't feel that you're judged for not wearing them, so long as you're not a TV presenter or something.
Yeah, like a lot of people do feel like they are pressured to wear them. Like, so do you listen to the Brexiteer, the Romaniacs podcast?
I don't know.
No, so it's. I think it's brilliant for obvious reasons.
It literally called the Romaniacs?
Yes.
Okay.
I would like to say I coined that term, and it has been stolen from me.
I'm fairly sure you weren't the first person to use that phrase.
Well, I came up with it on my own, so I think I'm really clever. But they felt actually there were a load of like lefty North London liberals,
right.
So they're very much my people, but they seem almost repressed by their by the necessity, especially if you're going on television, and the vitriol that is directed towards them whenever they don't wear a poppy, and they feel bullied into it. Whereas I, and perhaps if I'd been through that situation and people had made me feel or intended to make me feel shamed because I wasn't wearing a poppy, maybe then I would push back more against it. But because it has always been a choice of mine that I have actually actively done myself, I'm very happy to do so. And we're joking about it, but precisely because I have gotten to define the terms by which I get to wear it.
And you're saying the Romaniac podcasters don't get to define the terms?
Well, no, because a lot of them are public figures and have to go on TV and talk about politics and...
Are these like prominent journalists?
Like Ian Dunt is one of the...
Oh, right, okay, yeah. He's like a world-class Ramona, though, isn't he? So he's probably upset about a lot of things these days.
Yeah, he's everything I want to be.
I think I said this on the unreleased podcast episode, and I'm just going to sneak it in again, is that...
Please stop referring to it. People need to know that it existed.
Is that Ramonas have an incredible persecution complex for a group of people that is still a majority in Parliament, is still a significant... probably most of the broadcast media, although not most of the newspaper press, and is also... probably most top businessmen as well in the country, and has an enormous amount of cultural capital and clout, and an enormous amount of influence, and they just walk around as though they're being fucking persecuted all the time. Essentially like this sort of warped left-wing parody of people that moan about political correctness gone mad. Like, you're not being persecuted, just some people don't like your life choices, you know. It's fine, just go about your day.
Excellent, cool.
On that bombshell,
on that bombshell, shall we wrap up?
Yes, you can find me on Twitter at JDE Nichols if you're voraciously offended by something that I've said.
And you can find me at Jazza John, but only tweet me if you agree with me.
Yes, he's a very delicate snowflake type.
I'm a flower.
Okay. And you can actually tweet the podcast as well at Right Dishonor. It does occasionally tweet back at people, And you can find us at writedishonorable.com, where we post podcast episodes and occasional articles. And also, if you want to throw us some money, it's patreon.com/writedishonor, or is it Write Dishonorable?
It's Write Dishonorable.
There we go. Sorry, okay. I was thinking of Twitter. You know, it's complicated. Just Google, right. You'll find it. It'll be fine.
Right. Brilliant. Bye, everybody. Love you lots.
Bye-bye.